Hello, it's nice to be back here. We enjoyed The Origins of Morality last time. It's great to be back. A couple of things just about the running order. What we're going to do is I'm going to introduce the speakers one by one. They'll give a brief presentation, then we'll do a moderated panel. And there'll be some discussion of some of the questions that some of you sent in on Facebook and Twitter and all the other things. The basis for the debate will really start around this wonderful little book, for me at least, by Erwin Schrödinger, which some lectures he gave in February of 1943, and the title is What is Life? And this was a great stimulus for a great many people who were physicists and mathematicians at the time, who then went into biology. Science Network's headquarters, we're lucky, were in Francis Crick's old house in La Jolla, and Francis was a colleague at the Salk Institute. Francis went into biology, as did Jim Watson, precisely because they'd read this little book of Schrödinger's. But let's, without more ado, let me ask you one question. Does anybody have a birthday today?
Charles Darwin.
Charles Darwin. So perhaps you'd like to say happy birthday, Charles Darwin. Thank you. And there could be no more appropriate person to be his first speaker, having invoked Charles Darwin, than Richard Dawkins. Who apparently needs no introduction. The former Charles Simonyi Professor of Public Understanding of Science at the University of Oxford, the founding one, author of dozens of absolutely wonderful books that have sold millions of copies. He has another reputation, but we'll get onto that later with the website. Richard Dawkins.
This may be the only planet in the universe that contains eyes to see it, brains to think about it, and wonder about it. I don't believe that. I suspect that there is plenty of life in the universe, but this is the only kind of life that we know about. The laws of physics apply all over the universe, and the laws of physics are never violated by life. Nevertheless, something very strange happens wherever there's life. The laws of physics are channeled through a very odd process, which was first discovered by the man whose birthday we've just celebrated, Charles Darwin. Life, to me, I would identify as anything which is highly statistically improbable, but in a specified direction. You have to add that specified direction because with hindsight you could say that any old heap of rubbish is statistically improbable in the sense that there's never been another heap of rubbish exactly the same. What's special about life is that living things are statistically improbable in a direction which you could have specified in advance. It's not always exactly the same, but birds are good at flying, fish are good at swimming, moles are good at digging, etc. All living things are good at something, whereas lumps of rock aren't. What exactly living things are good at, we learn from Darwin and his successors. They're good at surviving, but there's a little bit more to it than that. It's not just that they're good at surviving as individuals, they're good at passing on the coded information that built them in the first place. Natural selection is the royal road to complexity from simple beginnings. We know of no other way, and I'll stick my neck out and say there is no other way in which the powerful illusion of purpose which living things show, could have come about. Once Darwinian natural selection has given rise to living things which have brains or some sort of data processing machinery, it then becomes possible that purpose is no longer an illusion. Purpose then becomes actually a product of brains or whatever substitute for brains might exist on other planets. Lawrence began by mentioning some other things which apparently have some of the properties of life. He mentioned forest fires. I can tell you very simply what's wrong with that. Forest fires do indeed reproduce in the sense that Lawrence meant, in that you've got a forest fire here, and then a spark or a flying piece of fire goes up into the air and is carried by the wind, lands somewhere else in the forest and starts a new fire. So there is reproduction among fires, but it's not true reproduction in the genetic sense, and here's very precisely why. It would be true reproduction, or true replication, I should say, if the qualities of a fire were carried in the spark that initiates it. So if you could imagine that there's a bit of fire over here, which has a sort of bluish tinge because maybe there's some copper in the soil or something like that, and the spark flies across to another part of the forest. If that bluish tinge were inherited by the daughter fire, then that would indeed be a true analogy for genetics. But that doesn't happen. The qualities of a fire are given to it by the local environment, by the quality of the trees, by the soil, or whatever it might be. It is not carried in the spark. And that's what gives life its very, very peculiar property. It is the spark that travels from one fire to the next. It is the genes that travel from one organism to the next that carry that part of the attributes of the organism that matter for evolution, and evolution is what matters for producing the complexity and the illusion of purpose that characterizes life. Crystals have some properties that resemble living things. They can be very beautiful, very elegant, very perfect shapes, and if you wander into a cave full of crystals, you might even think that you had wandered into a living zoo. But crystals don't have this singular property of reproduction in the precise way I've indicated, with genetic information being carried from one generation to the next. But, you might well say, aren't I just describing the way life is on this planet? How do we know that this would be the property of life if we were to discover it on another planet? Well, we don't know that. This is almost an article of faith. I would stick my neck out and say that there is only one way for this property of complexity, this illusion of design in specified directions, purposeful directions, pseudo-purposeful directions, can come about, and that is by natural selection, which is the non-random survival of randomly varying self-replicating information. When one says randomly varying, that only means that it varies in a direction which is not specifically aimed towards improvement in the way that evolution is. The reason why evolution ends up with an improved result, with a more complex result, with a result that flies better, swims better, digs better, or whatever it is that these random changes are cumulative over many generations. So in any one generation, you just call it random. But when you stack up a whole series of generations of these improvements, which are improvements by definition because they survive, then you end up with highly complicated machines like eyes, which resemble cameras or telescopes, like ears, like elbows, like kidneys, and so on. There seems to be no obvious limit to the complexity which this Darwinian algorithm is capable of generating. It's generated us. It's generated us who have brains capable of looking around, reflecting on our existence, wondering about our existence, and finally, in 1859, solving the riddle of our existence.